This is an interview with Professor John Ross of the Ag Journalism Department. He's been the head of profs for the last 4 years. We're doing the interview in his office. The date is July 12th, 1985. My name is Laura Smale. I'm doing the interview for the University Archives Oral History Project. Testing. 1, 2, 3.
You want to test me too?
Yeah, you're fine.
Okay.
Let's try this without the fan.
I think that as the merger proceeded, I really do believe that the Madison faculty was caught a little unawares. The governance structure was well in place, but certainly pre-merger, the legislative relations were somewhat more haphazard. Some people feel, had there been a faculty organization whose function was to deal with the legislature, that merger might not have happened. The final vote was by a margin of one, for example, and that was tenuous. People who were active at that time, I'm sure, will say that they were in contact with the legislature, but it wasn't as present as a function that the faculty might do at that time. The organization really didn't get underway, didn't get the push that's required, I think, to get faculty to join. A lot of faculty are apolitical by nature, was with the collective bargaining issue. I know for a fact that there was and is in the minds of some of the faculty at some of the other institutions in the university the idea that merger meant equality in the most structured way. That is, both in terms of function and salaries. We heard that repeatedly in the argument last winter over the catch-up compensation, mm-hmm. that merger meant that we were going to be treated the same. And I've picked up in my political job a number of times from faculties at some of these other institutions is that the reason they aren't as good as Madison is that they don't have the time to behave in a scholarly way. And one of the ways you behave scholarly is to have time to do research or writing. And in order to do that, you have to have a reallocation of the budget. There is not as much understanding of freelancing or entrepreneurship in academia, how one gets research money or this sort of thing. But nevertheless, I think that Prof's creation was as a response to things that were happening. And the two that stand out in my mind first was the merger and the feeling still among many Madison faculty that the merger has not served us well. The collective bargaining, the drive for that, particularly in some of the other campuses, certainly predates merger. But the combination of the merger and the expectation of some other faculties of what would come from that, I have no doubt stimulated the drive among those people to get through bargaining what they could not get through the merger. There are other reasons why PROS was formed, but that, I think, is the historical context.
You know, this must be in writing somewhere, but I find I don't know what percentage of the cluster campuses that TAUWF represents, of the people.
They have chapters on all of the campuses except Madison. One of the reasons they have not organized a chapter here is because of the existence of United Faculty, which is also affiliated with the American Federation of Teachers. They have claimed on the order of 3,800 members. from faculty and academic staff, if you look at the payroll deductions, it's considerably less than that. And it varies from campus to campus about the proportion that our staff is compared to faculty, but my impression is that about half of their membership is staff.
Oh, wow, that is interesting.
And if you look at the membership campus by campus, my figures are a little old, and these could be checked, say 6 months to a year. Probably the largest membership on any campus is slightly under 50%. And it ranges down to 5 or 10%. The most active people in TALF number 200 at most. And this is not to say that those people who don't pay dues are not interested in the goals of that organization, but it would be just simply incorrect to say that this was a majority of faculty on those campuses or a majority of faculty in the university. It's a very vocal organization, has an agenda. The extent to which it is the wave of sentiment of the faculty, I think, is very much in doubt.
So, carry on.
I might say one thing here at this point regarding profs and TALF. We really don't have much in common philosophically.
Do you have anything in common?
Well, let me point out where I think the sharpest differences are. There certainly is a difference in attitude about how faculty participate in the governance of the university. There are certain logistical things where we certainly have not been antagonistic. Issues like retirement and fringe benefits, these kinds of things. And those things are obviously very important to the life and well-being. In the area of governance, in the area of the role of faculty in the structure and the distribution of power, in the kinds of relationships that we like to have with administration and regents, we are just very, very different. I think profs is no more or no less than the prevailing sentiment of the Madison faculty. I have worked very hard not to get out in front in that regard. The university committee tries not to get out in front as well, very hard. In the case of TALF, they're out way out in front, and they have a defined agenda. Ours is one basically of letting faculty do their thing within the legal and moral constraints that we all have, but we're essentially reactive. TALF people are not. They want to reform things, I think quite clear.
Well, I would assume they'd be close to United faculty.
An interesting division showed up this last year, and I thought it made it quite difficult for some of the United faculty people. They were caught in the bind of regularizing and leveling. The United faculty in Madison feel that the current governance structure has weaknesses, and there are better ways to address that. But I've not met one with whom I've had a confidential conversation that wasn't very much alarmed about the attempts to make salary a function of time and grade and not representative. I mean, I haven't found any United faculty yet that are willing to abandon the merit or say that Madison doesn't have unique characteristics. And some people were in a bind because of that. I'm not saying that I think they feel they should have their cake and eat it too, but there was a conflict in the minds of the people I talked to. They were caught caught in a system that seemed to be bigger than they were at the moment, many of them.
Because they don't, they're not really very much in favor of profs, is that right?
The United faculty. Only once have I felt in the 5 years that there was an element of bitterness. I mean, I have not sensed personal attacks, nor you're the bad guys and we're the good guys kind of relationship. And through the years, we've had close contact with the United faculty leadership. I've tried to keep that. It's more a matter of, is the faculty structure strong enough to protect the rights and interests of the faculty? Where the difference, and it's a disagreement over method, mm-hmm. I think, more than it
but
is
that's
over.
That's your position.
That's my position.
Yeah. I mean, Croft's position.
Yes. Profs from day to day is never out of touch with the university committee. Mm-hmm. I mean, I talk to members of the university committee every day, 2 or 3 times a day.
Now, when you say every day, you don't mean every 365 days a year.
In the last year, Fannie Lemoine and I probably had 2 or 3 conversations every weekend on the phone. It was a complicated, tough year, but a lot of faculty governance, as you well know, Laura, takes place in the evening and on the weekend.
Yes, actually, partly I was thinking of that, but partly I wonder, you have been absolutely steadily going at it for a year. There hasn't been any letdown. Is that right for
That's
you?
That's correct.
Uh-huh. Has it been that way for the whole, you've been director for 4 years?
Six.
Six?
Yes.
So you preceded O'Neill.
By half a year.
Uh-huh. And
he's been here 5.5 years as of this July.
So you're 79, the middle of 79.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Back to kind of the philosophy and the formation, it was generated in the struggle over bargaining. I mean, that's kind of the tipping point. But if you back off from that a bit, yeah, it does two things. First, it protects the faculty's role against fairly constant pressure from a whole host of directions. Second, it performs a watchdog function on the administration. If it is an extension of the administrative legislative relationships, then it's redundant. Mm-hmm. Just the existence of it performs a function regarding the administration. There ought to be a healthy struggle between the administration and the faculty all the time. Let me give you an example of one of the forces at work where an organization like this serves a function. Right now, there is a great deal of pressure to regularize the academic staff. And this job description, job titles, job progression, governance rights, all of these kinds of things.
And the pressure comes from whom?
It comes in part from the bureaucracy, who find it difficult to deal with a beast that's hard to label. It comes in part internally from people who say we don't have these rights. It comes in part from the distinction between a tenured faculty person and an academic staff person who, let's face it, performs an auxiliary function. Terribly important, but auxiliary. All right, now the way in any complex institution, you try and protect the rights of the individual so that they don't get abused, so that they get a fair shake. That's first policy priority. You can do that because of a diffuse decision-making structure where there's respect and this sort of thing. You can start to superimpose a structure and rules on top of that. That's what we're in now. We're in the process of regularizing the academic staff. There is currently a committee meeting appointed by the regents under a threat from downtown that we're going to bring this thing under control. And its perspective of one is, how do we get orderliness and titles into this? The perspective has not all that much to do really with the educational function of the institution, only indirectly, and it doesn't really recognize the existence of and the authority of the faculty and the reasons for that, which is the independent pursuit of knowledge. What we're going to end up with, I predict, in 5 years, is a shift in the decision-making authority from the faculty to the bureaucracy regarding the academic staff. There's a real possibility that people will be transferred over into the state civil service, or at least some of them. There is also the possibility that academic staff would bargain contracts, wages, working conditions, these kinds of things. One of the consequences of that will be that the faculty will turn to other structures to perform the functions the way they want them performed. For example, right now, visiting professors are academic staff, by definition. It's a definition of convenience, not a real function. And so Profs then says, now wait a minute, you know. Are we addressing the real problems that we have with this class of personnel? Are there problems of unfairness, unfair treatment? Is this elaborate civil service kind of structure the way to address them or not? And if that is imposed, what then are the consequences? And you'll find my successor working on this question either at the level of statutes, or at the level of rules, or at the level of policy. Because there are a lot of people in the legislature that have and will continue to be interested in this. The existence of the organization, it's not the perspective of the administration, it's not the perspective of the oversight in state government, it's the perspective of the faculty that we try to represent. And the academic staff thing is just one issue.
The threat from downtown, that's the legislature.
The legislature very often responds to the state bureaucracy. To some extent, the governor's office, which is under the pressures of election. But it is as much the Department of Administration, the Department of Employment Relations, and the infrastructure for the management of government. We've got to be efficient, we've got to have compliance and accountability, we've got to have uniformity because it's much easier to administer. You have to have public accountability, yes, question mark. So there's also what I would call bureaucracy in the better sense, and what flows from an elaborate bureaucratic structure as applied to the university, which is always going to be disorganized, or at least it will appear to be from the outside. So it's that clash, as well as some people who say, well, we've got to organize workers for whatever set of reasons, philosophical or economic or whatever.
So somebody in the university has to be responsible for trying to persuade them downtown, or have you already conceded on this?
No.
Because you say it's already underway.
It's underway, but we've conceded nothing.
You have. You think you can talk them out of it?
Well, What you look for in the political process is the point of decision. And even after the fact, you look at the points of decision. And what are the points of decision? When a policy is reduced to paper, when a vote is taken, when a budget is framed and passed, when a rule is made, when a policy is implemented or not. Profs has not, and I would not expect to be involved in political action, that is the actual election. It's quite possible and historically a fact that faculty have had a major role in elections, particularly in the Madison area. But we have not as an organization and will not, because we've got to work with whomever is elected. But it's this representation of the faculty interest at the point of decision, which is the point of the whole thing.
I would have thought that the administration would also see, be on the faculty side here, that is the university administration, wouldn't want this to happen.
In my tenure in this job, our relationships with the administration, the Madison campus administration, have been excellent, in my judgment. You can ask them the same question. We have been in close contact, we have exchanged views, we've had many arguments.
By this you mean with Irving Shane?
Or with Harry Peterson, or with Bernie Cohen and before Bernie Bry, with the budget people. These arguments have always been civil, in my judgment. We have not set out to confront. It should be remembered that if I'm anything more, or the person in this position is anything more than a mirror image of the university committee and through them the Senate, then it's getting a little awry. It's not a power base. I've never been hesitant to state my view internally. I have not and would not go to the press to carry out one of those arguments. It just seems to me to destroy a relationship that is tender. We are at arm's length from the administration. Very often I've gone to Harry Peterson and said, look, I think you're in trouble on this, or I think the faculty are going to disagree with you on this. And that is a kind of registration that you can't make if you're screaming at each other. And so I think our relationship has been at arm's length but healthy with the administration, which is what it should be. I'm convinced that I think the argument over salary differential in the university system was inevitable, but I'm convinced that it would not have happened when it did without the existence of the interest of Madison faculty and the profs organization. I just think that it may have, but I doubt it. The initial effort, the initial definition, came from faculty groups here in Madison. The definition of peer groups as a basis for making this decision was conceived in the university committee office 6 months before anybody else heard about it.
It's very interesting.
So you see, so there we've not been placid and responsive totally, but at the same time, we felt that if we were at odds with the administration on something as important as that, it wouldn't have gone anywhere. But the initial effort and the definition came from faculty groups on that. This is an issue where we may not be at odds, but it's...
You're giving an example.
I'm giving... of the relationships with the university. And it's the current flap over the behavior in athletics. Let me use that as an example of the relationship between a faculty group that's involved in attempts to influence policy and the administration who has the responsibility for defining the policy. There is almost a consensus now about people who are thinking about it that the faculty is up in arms over the way the athletic program is being administered and that some serious changes are needed. On the other hand, there's quite a bit of evidence that there's some very powerful and influential people who think there's nothing wrong here and that perhaps it's not the athletic administration that should be changed or curtailed, but the campus administration. And there's even some discussion of a lack of confidence in the chancellor on this issue. Okay, if the faculty has the authority to determine the policies and the operations, the administration of the athletic program, we have faculty governance here, and may force that issue at the cost of a chancellor. See, that's, and the chancellor would feel that he was in an impossible position. Now, this is an extreme case, but let's say that we, on a less extreme case, let's say that we want to press something like differential pay, catch-up comparisons, or even the funding of a particular program or the priorities of those fundings. And we have a disagreement with the administration about the direction or the priorities. You have to come to some resolution, and somebody has to either make the decision or you come to some consensus. And we're out of line because we don't have the authority nor the responsibility on those things given to the chancellor and the president or the regents in the statutes. On the other hand, we do have a responsibility to share in that and to determine the academic program, the research and the instruction. And there's always the possibility that we will disagree on either the timing or the tactics or the policy. The athletic thing is going to come to a head, and it's going to be the faculty versus something that the chancellor has to respond to or thinks he does. And it's not clear now how that's going to turn out. And it's a serious issue. Another major one...
Before you go on,
could I just
comment that It has been said that the faculty committee was very remiss, the athletic board, which is a faculty committee, isn't it?
The faculty senate and or the university committee will tell the faculty committee, shape up.
Hmm.
And although that particular committee is appointed by the chancellor, the faculty governance structure will say you are not performing the way we think you should.
And you have the power to change the... Well, not to change the
To rewrite the policies.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the faculty senate could say, we're going to drop intercollegiate athletics.
Mm-hmm.
Or we're going to drop football. They could make some statements about confidence in the administration of the program. They could rewrite the rules by which the athletic board operates. So they do have a great deal of authority.
So that's something that would happen in September.
Or sooner. I've been director of PROS for 6 years, and it's only in those 6 years that I'm most aware of these issues and who the actors are and those sorts of things. It's been obvious in those 6 years and even earlier that Madison faculty salaries were losing ground. In part, this is because of a series of actions concerning the university by the administrations downtown, specifically governors. In part, it was this growing pressure to make salaries uniform within the merged university system. In part, it was because of the way the budget is constructed and some of the flexibility in some of the other institutions to add to salaries. We lost ground to inflation until 2 years ago. We lost ground to competitors. There is a lag time in response in who you can recruit and who you can retain. But in the last 3 or 4 years, it was becoming patently obvious that the symptoms were getting stronger about loss of quality. I think it came more on the side of earlier on the side of recruitment than it did on the side of retention.
People were saying they wouldn't come.
Couldn't get your first, second, or third mm-hmm. choice. And this, there are differences by category of faculty, but it was happening across the university. The humanities, engineering, the sciences, the life sciences, social sciences, everywhere. In the Dreyfus years, there was one biennium in which the salary increases were competitive at that time. Certainly there was no redress of either the inflation or the longer term problem. The whole problem started clearly in my mind in the Lucy years, which were very unfriendly years for the university mm-hmm. in a number of categories. Dreyfus was not at all helpful to the university in operations and teaching loads and these kind of things. And however, we didn't lose as much ground in that administration in average salaries. Governor Earle, for a series of reasons regarding public employee salaries, looking at the university's problems over the last 10 to 12 years, and he made the worst decision at the worst time for faculty. And that, of course, is what precipitated this whole argument over catch-up and differential catch-up. There isn't any doubt at all but what Governor Earle's action to freeze salaries is what shattered the crystal. Mm-hmm. Although it was a problem that was growing. So you had a loss to inflation, you had a gradual erosion of structure, you had the pressures of the merger, and then you had this absolutely devastating freeze for 2 years. One of the symptoms it was the inability to hire assistant professors and the actual drop in number of assistant professors at the time when student enrollments were continuing to mount. We were not getting enrollment funding and we were not getting redress on libraries and these kinds of things. So it was ripe for either a fairly drastic decline in the quality at Madison or some kind of an unusual revolutionary adjustment in the problem. It was made bitter and complicated by the internal conflict between the faculties at the other institutions and Madison. You could put together any set of data, and we put together a number of them, which would show, number one, that the faculties at these other campuses competitively were doing quite well. And if you have any confidence in the peer comparison, at the end of this biennium, those campuses are going to be at the top of the heap nationally in average salaries, and we're going to be fluttering around the median of a compromised peer group. And the salary increases here look pretty good now, but they really aren't. competitively. We have a way to go.
Now, this, what you've been saying has been covered in newspaper articles. I would like to know when you yourself first became aware of this as something more than just a problem with the faculty, as something that you in profs were going to have to deal with, or you said?
As the executive director of profs, I sat in on all of the meetings of the Faculty Compensation Commission starting 6 years ago.
That was the one that Smith, Donald Smith chaired.
Yes, he did. Usually the chair has 2 year sequence, and there have been three or four chairs while I've been sitting in on their meetings. I was aware of this problem the first year, and I can remember a couple of sessions in the university committee when I said, this is coming, we're going to have to meet this. And at least some people then were saying, including Irv Shane, it's a politically impossible.
Hmm. Now, you're saying this back in, what, 80, 81, 82?
Yes. It wasn't until Governor Earle's action that everybody says, you know, this is getting desperate. And I think one of the other early people to spot this and talk about our inability to recruit the star assistant professors was Bryke Earle. Mm-hmm. I can remember 4 or 5 years ago, he's saying, you know, we're going to decline. It was under the chairmanship of Fannie Lemoine, and Fannie is largely responsible for conceiving the strategy of how to address this. And the summer, we knew that the regents were getting uptight, and we knew that we guessed that the governor had to get out from under a lot of the flack he was getting, and it was intense public flack. Would appoint some kind of a commission or a blue ribbon group. So that summer before that happened, Fannie and I conceived of a structure, and she appointed three committees to address this. One of those committees was called a budget structure committee, and it was a group of about five or six. And over the summer, we laid out the tactics on how to address this and the policy changes that we thought were needed to address it. And it's not just the pay adjustment, but it's the budget structure that enables you to do this. And that report was on hand at the first meeting of the governor's task force. Arthur DeBartoleben, who was on that task force, knew what was coming. And Mary Lou Munce was on that committee as well. And with some modifications, that is in fact what that committee adopted, was that study that we conducted the summer before. They adopted the structure of it, and then the political pressures made some modifications. And we didn't have all of the data at that time, of course, too.
So you were on this committee, you weren't just sitting in on
I was a member of Fannie's subcommittee on the budget process that summer. And we spent a good many hours that summer arguing it through. The word master on that committee, person who has an uncanny sense of the structure of a public university and knows how to implement it, is Don Smith. Don put in, documented the history in the Lucy years. Not all of it was in the final report, but it was probably the best assessment of what I've seen of the damage that Governor Lucy did to the university in his administration. And then we went on from there, given Don's analysis of the history of how we got there.
Don had left the administration because of
That's
his
correct.
Health.
He was at that time a professor in communications art on the Madison campus.
Was it I mean, his health was, he had a heart attack, isn't that right?
He just barely survived that heart attack, mm-hmm. and but that was after this work was essentially done.
Oh, I see.
This was the summer before that heart attack.
Mm.
Millard Sussman, who is the current chair of the University Committee, did an absolutely brilliant report on the economic impact of the Madison campus on the economy of the state. It was never formally or flamboyantly presented. It was done in mimeograph form. It's had wide distribution and served another purpose. There was a third committee, which just simply wasn't as strong, and that was titled Instructional Quality and the Environment for Instruction and the Meaning of Quality. Mm. And that committee flopped around. And I guess I feel that issue will come back as we get into this argument over enrollment caps and that sort of thing. We will look again at the issue of quality and instruction.
So you don't think it was just that it's too vague an issue, but just the people on the committee didn't take hold of it?
I don't think they took hold of it.
Mm-hmm.
The first two subcommittee reports were outstanding. The third one didn't grab as well. And it's too bad, because one of the arguments used by some of the other institutions in this fight mm-hmm. was that we do all of the undergraduate instruction and it's as good as, if not better than, what happens in Madison, mm-hmm. which is outrageously untrue on both counts. And had we had that quality of instruction report, we might have held some of that off.
Oh.
I want to leave the impression, Laura, that I feel that this is not a community of scholars, this merged system. There are a lot of points on which we are intently competitive with the other institutions.
Yes, I have no doubt of that.
And this is not downgrading those people, but it is not underestimating the size of the struggle that's going on.
Did you at any time go to O'Neill when you were preparing these, when these committees were working this out? Yes, to O'Neill. Or to anybody else in central administration?
The relationships with O'Neill have been somewhat more formal, certainly than with his predecessor. And some of the reasons for that are obvious. Edwin Young is one of the better known faculty members in terms of personal relations. The university committee sat down a number of times with O'Neill and with Catherine Lyle,
mm-hmm.
often in the context of sending a strong message, saying here's what we're going to do and here's why we're going to do it, and here's what we think you should be doing. This happened fairly frequently, either the whole committee or the chair of the committee or others. My personal contacts with O'Neill were not all that great.
All that great or all that many?
All that many.
Hmm.
Great in number.
Yeah.
We often met in the hall in the Capitol or on the way back and forth
mm-hmm.
and exchanged information. My personal relationship with him was always very positive. We have a great deal of respect for each other. I was not about to get myself in the position where I was doing something with the president of the system that the chancellor here did not know about.
Well, that was a difficulty, wasn't it?
It certainly, if I went to O'Neill with information or with stories, then my credibility here would be shot very quickly.
Mm.
But from time to time, we did sit down and talk about strategies.
So, in more than just casual encounters.
Oh yes.
So you would go up to his office
yes.
and talk to him.
Yeah.
Did you request meetings, mm-hmm. or did he request
both?
Them?
I had regular contact with Wally Lemon, who overlapped as the chief lobbyist for System. Mm-hmm. We met regularly on a number of different issues. I find Wally a superb tactician, underrated at home. With
at,
Ron,
at home, you mean in
within
the
central
administration,
yes,
or here?
In the central administration. With Bornstein's coming in, the relationship was regular but somewhat more formal. Vice President Bornstein. In the last 9 months to a year, we've had superb regular contact with Judith Ward, who came here, as you probably know, from a legislative staff position. She understands the legislature thoroughly. She's absolutely honest and forthright and a very good tactician and has a lot of credibility in the legislature. So I would say that our relations with System Administration have been somewhat more formal, never circumspect, and on balance, good.
You mean you could speak frankly to
absolutely
each other?
On the collective bargaining issue, right down to detailed tactics on who should speak at what hearing and say what, and very carefully planned who should write what letters with what timing, nose counting, who the votes are that we needed. I have tried. It is the responsibility of the chancellor to put together a budget and forward it to the president. Profs has been fairly stepped back from the budget process, other than the salary issue and the fringe benefits, simply because we think it is the responsibility of the administration to do that. Here's the kind of problem you can get into. Let's say that somebody comes in laterally, or deans are competing with each other for budgets, operations, or buildings, or whatever. It's one of the toughest problems that the chancellor has to put that budget together with the competing deans. Mm-hmm. He doesn't need, and it would be harmful to have a faculty group messing around in that. If they said, here's a relationship between governance or faculty interests and the budget, and on consultation we decided we ought to take part, then we did, but not on our own, that would be destructive. Mm-hmm. And so we always stayed somewhat aloof from the budget. Although I think that the faculty is playing formally a larger role in the budget than they were 6 years ago when I started. There were a lot of trade-offs this time around between faculty compensation and operating budget, and that had to be considered and thought about carefully.
Shane must have, did he follow along on the work you were doing, your committees were doing on faculty pay and on faculty contribution to the state?
Yes. Yeah. Once
you
we
wouldn't have disagreed on that.
No.
Shane would not.
Once we assessed the extent to which we were bending in the wind here in Madison on this faculty pay issue, and once there was internal consensus that this was the priority, then I would say that we were very much a chamber orchestra together. There were no disharmonies. Harry Peterson, who is Shane's assistant on lobbying, and I spent many, many hours together on the finest kind of details on this. Mm-hmm. And it would be a gross misrepresentation to say that profs did this alone operationally. I think we forced the issue, or were significant in forcing the issue. But I think that the chancellor and his staff, including the budget people, were absolutely decisive in how it turned out. As we decided, and as the study committees were appointed in the legislature. We worked together legislator by legislator and kept tab on where people were coming from and what they were thinking and who was necessary and this sort of thing.
You mean you and the chancellor's office?
Yes. Yes.
Before you, I don't know that you're leaving this subject, but I am curious as to how the relations between Shane and O'Neill affected anything you were doing.
That's a complicated topic, which is covers many more issues than just the faculty pay issue. Mm-hmm. Let me say a couple of general things first. It was relatively easy for Madison, now we're talking faculty and chancellor, to stake out their needs in their territory and then press for them. And the result shows that by and large on the catch-up we got what we asked for very early. And it was essentially protecting that position. O'Neill had the problem of chancellors who were out of line and of a very hostile faculty group, TALF, who were going to the press mm-hmm. with votes of lack of confidence and these kinds of things. And regents that were not uniformly in agreement on this issue. So his problem, in a sense, was a lot tougher because he had no consensus. So that's one thing that needs to be said. The second thing is that I don't think from the beginning when O'Neill came in that either it was not laid out for him by the regents and he didn't understand what Shane's authority and responsibility and turf were as compared to his. Yeah. Whether or not, if that had been a laid out, I don't know if the relationship would have been easier. But it's easy to say that the relationship was tense, including on the catch-up salary thing. There was never much doubt in my mind that O'Neill felt very strongly that the real problem was here in Madison and not elsewhere on salaries, and that that had to be addressed. But because of all of these other pressures, you were never sure how it was going to come out and how he might respond to those pressures. There was never any doubt in our mind about Shane. But you have a background of Madison being by far the biggest fish in this pond, with tension between the chancellor and the president, which was beyond the kind of healthy tension you would expect, and a very tough situation, with nobody really knowing how it was going to come out. You see, if they had allocated and across the board in the catch-up, which is what a lot of the other chancellors wanted, it would have been an absolute disaster for Madison, an absolute disaster. There's no doubt in my mind but what the character of the institution would have changed fairly rapidly. So there was a lot at stake here. Mm-hmm. I would say I was around a lot of times when the chancellor expressed his frustration on specific issues. I'm not sure that those are as important as the kind of the general not very healthy relationship.
Specific issues, and you mean O'Neill's policy on specific issues?
Or when he would issue a statement or do something that raised hackles.
Can you remember any example?
One from today. again, on the athletic thing, and that is the procedure by which we should draft a statement on accountability is an example. Mm. mean, should system administration take the lead, or should they delegate that authority to the campuses, in this case, this campus, to line out that policy? So it was usually where the line of responsibility and authority is on campus-by-campus policies that was frustrating. I don't think there's a certain social competitiveness. Another example was when the president decided that the system should have the fundraising capabilities that the UOW Foundation has, and at one point he actually made a move to step in on the operations of the foundation. And this is a Madison organization. It's absolutely vital to our future, private fundraising. And the Alumni Association, the foundation, these auxiliary functions are Madison's turf, and system, when they try to move in on those, there's going to be a real fight.
Because you think they will?
O'Neill made one or two attempts to step in on that, and fights resulted. I'm not too sure I can predict the future on those kinds of things. There are two things currently that make Madison unique, and one flows from the other. The first thing is the quality of the staff, faculty. Mm-hmm. That's the uniqueness. From that flows a funding capability that is also unique, incomparable in the country anywhere. Why? Mm. Now, if you superimpose on that a system which says we're going to start to get our hands in that and maybe divert some to Milwaukee, you know, that's where the real rub comes, yeah, on those kinds
of things. And O'Neill actually contemplated that, did he?
I think so.
I seem to remember something in the newspapers, but it was only very brief.
Yes. The record will show when they started to make some designs on the operation of the foundation.
But they backed off.
Yes.
Wait. This is take two of the interview with John Ross.
There are other kinds of things. For example, in the whole budget planning process and the allocation process, the extent to which information is available on data and how that's shared and the prerogatives on who makes the first draft of a policy and these kinds of things are all points of contention. One of the things we found in to win the salary adjustment and the differential treatment for Madison, it was essential that we have data, accurate data, and these from other institutions. Mm-hmm. Some of these are available from the national associations, and some of it you have to get. If you should talk to Martha Casey or Glenn Watts in the budget office, you'll find that one of their deep frustrations is the inability to get data out of system administration on what's going on. It is just held very tightly to their chest on many occasions.
I thought it was the other way around. I thought system complained that Madison wouldn't give its data.
Well, I suspect there's a certain amount of gaming in it. I hear the Madison side, basically. But there were half a dozen cases in this whole salary argument when a data set would have been very valuable to us and we couldn't get it. We had to go out and beat the bushes and get it ourselves.
I don't understand why that should be, since O'Neill is sympathetic to having a greater increase for Madison. I think he would have been glad to.
Well, I might be putting ideas into his mind on this. two things. One is he has been committed to the system, even though I think he recognizes what Madison is and what's going on here. He would not have been true to his contract or his commitment if he had not tried to protect the integrated system. The second thing is more pragmatic, and that is that information is the basis of power. And if you're trying to sit on top of a struggling, arguing, complex system, one of the ways you keep control is to control the information flow. That's one of the basic lessons in internal management of an organization. Mm-hmm. Money and information are the way you administer.
I wonder if he was asked. I mean, I wonder if perhaps the I'll ask him this, you know, when I mm-hmm. talk to him.
Yeah.
But whether it might have been at the level of the budget people, do you know?
It might have been. And he might not even have been aware at the gap, of the gap,
yeah.
of the difficulty in getting information. It's possible. I found the political actors, the operators, much easier to get along with than the budget people. One of my functions was to sit on the system committee on fringe benefits, where you're talking about health insurance and retirement annuities and dental and these kinds of things. Terribly important and complicated, and a lot of big actors. The university is a relatively small hunk of the pie when compared to public school teachers and public employees and these kinds of things. I had to squeeze awfully hard to get information sometimes about even the studies they were doing on alternative life insurance or the annuity packages. One of the things that happened in my tenure was the most significant reform in the retirement program for faculty in two decades.
This was Earl's, under Earl, was it?
Yes. This is the increase mm-hmm. in annuities. Well, those guys have a balance sheet, the people that run the retirement programs. Mm-hmm. And to date, many faculty don't know what they gave up in order to get the increase in the annuity. The technical experts have the distinct advantage in those kinds of things, because not only do they know, can they do the benefit cost analyses, but they know the long-term impact and the costs and these kinds of mm-hmm. things. And they know what the investment patterns are that the average person doesn't know. But those are terribly important kinds of issues. And system administration, I found often on the defensive when you would ask a question about what they were doing and why, and reluctant to tell you. Hmm. You had to squeeze it out.
Even though this was a system committee?
Yes, even though it was internal.
Why? Or is it the same answer?
In part, these answers are the basis of politics, and in part, they are the basis of how you react when somebody from the outside is questioning what you're doing. I think so. There's a kind of a social relationship there. So there's a certain amount of antagonism just in the process of getting this out on the table.
But this committee, which is represents other members of the
represents the, every institution, you know, in the system,
is trying to develop a better system package. Is that right?
That's right.
And you have to get figures from the system offices.
Yes, and this is not always
in order to do it, but you can't get them.
Yep.
That seems extraordinary to me.
Well, it happens.
I mean, I can see they're not giving them to somebody downtown, but...
Yeah. No, I think that In part, this is harder to explain, and I'm not sure how well I'll do it. If you look at the merged system in terms of the numbers on the portions, in any category you look at, Madison's the biggest. Very often the committee members approach these systems committees from these other campuses saying, we've got to defend ourselves against Madison.
Oh, I see.
There may not be all that much at stake. But you might think there is something at stake here. And when Madison comes in with its technical expertise and the clout of its share of the budget, particularly among those administrators who came in from the old state university system, there's a certain, you know, they're not going to run over us on this one kind of attitude, and I think that's built into some of the cooperation. To this date, the computer systems that we use to keep track of out-of-pocket operational expenditures are different for the two. And there isn't much doubt in my mind, but what Madison's accounting system is superior. Mm. Technically superior, yeah. And yet they won't adopt it. Why, you know, I don't know. Why don't people adopt new technology? So there's this kind of, at every level, competition. I'll make another frank comment. At almost every level at which I have worked, within the internal structure, bureaucracy structure kinds of things, over to the academic programs, there's a qualitative difference. There is simply more expertise coming out of the old University of Wisconsin on the building program and the management of it, at the management level. Madison has approached these questions with more intelligence and expertise than the others.
And then the system.
Yes.
Administration.
Yeah. So I just am convinced that the competence of the people is different. There are now in system administration, there are some exceedingly competent people. But when you had the old state university system people bumping up against the people that came out of the university structure, there was a qualitative difference. That has evolved so that it's somewhat over now. Mm-hmm. The people are hiring now are much more competent than they were even 5 years ago.
I see, even 5 years ago, you mean there was still a lag?
Sure.
I find I'm getting curious. You spoke of the two committees of the university committee that had mm-hmm. been formed, and it must have been your job then. Well, also Harry Peterson's, mm-hmm. but yours as well, to go down to persuade the legislators that Madison, the reasons why Madison yeah. needed.
I need to throw in here a little bit of my own philosophy.
All right.
On that. I'm a faculty person. I have the credentials and I hope the reputation. But also in the eyes of legislators with whom I was not well acquainted, I was the hired gun. And so if you went back and looked at the letters that were written, the appearances made at the hearings, many of the office contacts, you would find that 8 out of 10 of these contacts were made by various faculty people. I spent a great many hours down there, but every chance I got a department chair or a known mm-hmm. professor or a member of the university committee to make that contact. And it was a deliberate style. And through the years, we worked all the way across the university to get engineers and ag people and humanities people downtown are writing letters. So the disproportionately more of my effort was to discover the issues, frame them, working mm-hmm. with the university committee, briefing faculty, and then have faculty do it.
I see.
You would find now if you went downtown and asked legislators, half of them will know who I am. A fourth of them will know a lot more about me. But in those 6 years, there will have been 300 individual faculty members who made some kind of legislative contact. And that was an intentional style.
That must have been a rather tricky thing to do.
Yes.
Because you could alienate legislators,
that's
I'm
right.
sure.
That's right. And we made some individual mistakes by putting the wrong faculty person in the wrong position. I spent more time sitting in the back row of a legislative hearing than I did in front of the microphone, and it was very deliberate. This doesn't mean that we didn't make a lot of telephone calls and in informal contacts, but the more formal contacts were done by faculty.
Is when you say formal, you're talking about visits to offices. Do you include lunches? Did you do much
yes.
of that sort
yes.
of thing?
Yes, a great deal.
And this was, you also got faculty to do this?
Yes. Starting last summer, working into the fall, we had 40 legislators to lunch at the University Club, 40 different legislators, with never fewer than 5 faculty people at each one of those lunches from across the mm-hmm. university. And we worked through the leadership, through the committee members, members of Joint Finance, and we invited them out to the campus. For at least a significant number of these, it was the first time they had ever been invited to the Madison campus. And we'd let them set the agenda, but it was obvious what we were there for. It was the 15% for Madison faculty.
And they didn't mind coming, or they looked forward to it? How did they handle it?
Two people turned us down.
Who turned you down?
Senator Cullen turned us down.
Oh, I would figure, I guess.
And Senator George turned us down. Mm. We don't feel as badly about Senator George because we had a lot of other contacts, and he was co-chair of Joint Finance, and I think he was a little worried about it. But the rift between Madison and Senator Cullen has not and probably won't be repaired.
And what, he's the majority leader
in
of
the Senate?
Senate?
Yes. And I don't know any way to establish rapport.
And that's because he's one of the, what is it, Eau Claire? Or?
He's a graduate of Whitewater, but I think it's more complex than that in his case.
Do you know what it is?
Not really. Hmm. I think it's in part his bitterness about our successful opposition to bargaining. I think that's part of it. I think that there might be some social factors. I think he looks at Madison as an elite organization, mm-hmm. whether or not there are incidents. Very often, if you have an antagonistic legislator, it's some personal incident. At least two or three who have been bitterly opposed are people who didn't get into or flunked out of graduate school here. Mm-hmm. That sometimes is a basis for dislike. Mm. It's a personal experience.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's nothing you can do about that. Most of those people are civil, some of them are not. At this point, Laura, I might throw in my reaction to the legislature as a body. First, I think on balance they work extremely hard. Many of them are very competent. Most of them are very competent. And most of them understand the value and the problems of this institution. They get frustrated and they get emotional, but by and large, I think it's a very healthy relationship we have with the legislature.
This isn't something that you had to win them over to. They had it all along.
It's a little hard for me to assess that. I think the relations are better than when I started. You cannot, in this complex social process, you cannot sort out the proportion that any one individual gives to the resolution of a problem or the votes on an issue. Harry Peterson, who is Shane's assistant, is one of the most competent people I have ever worked with in any contact. He's absolutely skillful in the human relations side. Things, in, I'm convinced, would be not as nearly as good if he were not there. And his tenure pretty much overlaps mine. He was there a little bit earlier. But how can you say that what contribution we made when there's so many other actors? There's no point in making that assessment either.
Well, it certainly wasn't any of the other state universities.
That's correct. I'll put this into the record too. The director of TALF is Ed Music, former professor of history at Eau Claire. People repeatedly and jokingly in the legislature and here say that for heaven's sake, keep him on the job, because on balance, he helps Madison much more than he hurts because his ineptness and... I'm quite convinced that the battles in which we've been involved would have been much more difficult if Music had not been there. I think he's helped us a great deal.
Well, that's a nice statement to make.
And yet we've been just like that on most of the issues. In the salary debate, he succeeded in alienating his closest supporters. He really put them on the spot, in a public way. I'm not sure he senses the general ambience on that.
Now, when you'd have legislators to lunch with faculty, that would be different from their point of view from talking to Harry Peterson and having
sure
the Madison campus administration. They'd be more amenable to talking to you, I imagine.
Yes.
They wouldn't see it as quite so.
Harry is recognized as an honest, competent person. He has the confidence of most of the staff people in the Capitol. And he gets himself in a position where he has to slug it out with an individual and they're mad at each other for a while. It's a different kind of exchange, you see. Harry can be frank in ways that we cannot, and we can be more real than he can. But so the relationship is different. In my judgment, it's positive in both situations, with some exceptions. We have a handful of legislators who hate our guts. Madison.
Anybody in Madison.
Yes. Institutionally, there are a few. There are some that would rank us very low on their list of priorities. That's different than outright dislike. There are some who are responsive and responsible to constituents with whom we're in conflict. Are competitive. The kind of exchange, the legislator would expect Shane and Peterson to, quote, represent the institution.
Yes, that was my point.
When they sit down with a faculty person, they want to know, what are you doing in the classroom, in the research lab? What does that mean to the welfare of the state? How good is it? And it's just a different kind of...
So they really do ask those questions,
do they?
Oh, yes,
indeed. And they, on balance, most of them are delighted at the chance to talk to a working faculty person who has their kid in the classroom or is doing a research project in agriculture or high-tech engineering or wherever. And most of them are, if not respectful, almost in awe of some faculty, because you know there are a lot of world-renowned people right here in our town.
Do you get those too? Do you get the DeLucas and the?
Yes. We used them only at the most propitious time, because you don't want to invade their time either.
I noticed you had Temin. I suppose it was you who got Temin to talk to the governor at one point.
Yes, of course. Mm-hmm. But it's not just the DeLucas and the Temins. There might be somebody in English or German.
You don't mind the legislators see that we're doing useless things like that? I mean, are they able to comprehend it?
Absolutely.
They are. I shouldn't
Absolutely.
Say that. I was really quite shocked to discover, I think it's something like, what was it, 31 people in the legislature, in this assembly had a college education?
I think that's graduate degrees, if you're including law degrees.
No, it wasn't. It was, but it
oh,
was...
Oh, it's much higher than that.
I'll have to find that. It was graduated from Wisconsin.
Oh, I see. This is a fairly highly educated group. Mm-hmm. In the legislature. For example, one of the budget items, the new budget items for the university this year is an arthritis clinic. It's a valuable addition to our stock. It's because of a particular legislative relationship that happened right now.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not playing to special interests, but it's recognizing that the legislators in fact represent the citizens. And I think you have a responsibility to have that kind of exchange on programs and quality and that kind of thing. We're not aloof.
No,
doing? I'm getting kind of tired.
Are you?
Uh-huh.
Oh, okay. We're almost at the end of this tape, this side.
I'm very willing to come back at it again.